So, my name is Charles Severance. I'm the chair of Karaoke City. They'll be meeting tonight later, about 9:30, over by Yale Town. So, those who are interested in karaoke, join us. So Annie and I are going to do some grease stuff. And can't bring her skin tight black pants. I did bring my leather jacket.
You can't bring stuff.
Well, CD plus G, DVD, there's a lot of these things for karaoke. So, I have Sakai Overview Talk that some of you have probably seen 40 or 50 times. And so I'm going to just condense that talk down to one slide so I don't bother you with that. Sakai is a collaboration teaching and learning environment. It's a free, 3 years old, just baby software-wise. We have over 100 organizations that financially support us, 6 paid staff members for the foundation itself. It's really part of the sustainability. I'm really going to talk today mostly about the foundation and how we can do open source software and open standards. We have over 100 people doing our development and testing. We've got a map. And if you really, really, really badly want to see my talk, I have this talk. I have basically taken my stock Sakai talk, and you can give it back at your place, and it's on the web, and you can download the whole thing and carry it around with you and watch it over and over and over again, where I introduce what Sakai is and stuff about the Sakai community and stuff about the Sakai architecture. And in this video, I never lose my luggage, and so I always have a suit and tie in this video. And I've known a number of people that, when they give their talks, they just put this somewhere in the middle. When they're introducing Sakai on their campus, they throw me in. So that's the idea. This is available from either my personal site, drchuck.com, or from the sakaiproject.org site as well. So I'm not going to show you that. I'll just point you out that if you really wanted to know about Sakai, take a look at that video. Okay. So we're trying to look at open source and open standards kind of from a big picture. And so one of the things that I think is unique about the Sakai project is our business model, our sustainability model, our long-term approach. And our long-term approach is the Sakai Foundation. The key thing about the Sakai Foundation is the Sakai Foundation roughly has about $1 million of revenue per year. If you take a look at the web rating at olo.net, Sakai software is roughly valued at about $20 million at this point, meaning that if you were going to start and write Sakai from scratch tomorrow, you would go borrow from your bank or advance on your credit card about $20 million and hire developers for a while, and then they would write Sakai. So that, you know, that may be off by 50%, but it gives you a sense that it's hard to develop this software. It takes a long time to get high-quality, reliable software. And so with $1 million of revenue per year, there's little or no way that Sakai itself can hire enough developers to write Sakai. So that's why we're community source. That's why we have got to depend on places like Indiana University and Cambridge and Stanford and Berkeley and University of Michigan to do the real work of Sakai. The foundation is not the place that the work gets done. As a matter of fact, the foundation has exactly 0 developers. The closest thing that the foundation has to developers are me, as the executive director who does development in his spare time, and Anthony White, who's also here, who did the tool interoperability stuff, which took about 25% of his time. And the interesting thing about that is we're not really doing core development. We're actually doing standards work, and we're doing reference implementations for standards, because reference implementations for standards is not something that random volunteers really get the urge to do, and so that's something that I've chosen to do centrally with a small amount of the funds. So the only development we do centrally is really in support of standards activity. So the mission statement is really just to hold the ownership of the software and then create and nurture the community. And the organizational structure looks like this. I'm the executive director, and I report to a board of directors. And we have 3 basic things that we do. We have a requirements process, we have community communication, and we have software coordination. We don't call it project management because the people that are doing the work are actually all volunteers. Our development tree is all dotted line. So we have the Sakai Foundation that tries to do as much coordination as you can do, and buys pizza and buys beer and buys coffee for people. But at the end of the day, these are really volunteers, and we have to be nice to them, and we have to convince them to do the work that we want. So all the people who are developers in Sakai really work in some other organization, in some other org chart in that organization. And so the little blue dots there are these people who really work for me, as best I can tell, because I tell them to do stuff, and they do stuff. But really, they're being completely paid for by somebody else, and they do have a local boss. And, you know, we get somewhere between 10 and 70% of people that really dedicate themselves to the needs of the community, even though their job and their job title and their boss and their raises come from on site. So why is it that Sakai needs to do all this? I don't know how many people know the annual budget of the Apache Foundation, the software that drives the entire universe, web, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the entire budget of the Apache Foundation is $100,000 a year. $100,000 a year. Sakai is $1 million a year. So Sakai has 10 times more money than the Apache Foundation. And we don't do nearly as much as the Apache Foundation does. And why is that? And that's the difference fundamentally, as we see it, is that Apache's building infrastructure where if you can get 20 nerds talking to each other on a mailing list, you can actually do a pretty good job at building infrastructure that has literally no user interface. But when you try to build user-facing software that's going to be used by 1 million users, we're all going to complain like teachers and learners. The moment you make a mistake in that software, put the button in the wrong place, they got to yell at somebody. Where in Apache, when someone upgrades Tomcat, like do the faculty members using Tomcat start picking the phone up and yelling at people? So the game is a little different when you're building end user-facing software. So you can think of Sakai as Apache with a bunch of little projects, and then there's a whole bunch of coordination. You have projects like our portfolio project, like our quiz and test project. The framework itself is a project. These are all like little Apache projects, but then the foundation brings these together as a family, and we can't release these things separately. We release them together. We release twice a year. We're very careful about this. And so the key thing is the $1 million goes toward the coordination of these people that can't really work independently the way Apache can. Each Apache project releases when they feel like it, etc. We break our community into two parts. The top part is kind of our full release that's as close to like a course management system you can download. And then we have this Wild West kind of thing where we call Contrib, where just random groups of people or even in single individuals start doing crazy stuff, and they try to form communities about it. So there's this chaos Contrib space, and our goal in life is to get the code in the Contrib space, like Incubator and Apache, to the point where it can become part of the main release. So twice a year, we do a thing where we poll people to see which things should be promoted from Contrib to the main release. And then we QA the main release. Contrib is not QA'd. We even have a way in the main release to have things that are kind of in a permanent beta or a long-term beta for a one-release beta, usually one or two releases, called provisional, which means we QA them, we distribute them, but then we turn them off in the final distribution and make people turn them back on. So they're not used by default, so each adopting institution can take a list of things we qualify completely. Then there's these kind of beta things in a release, and then they can promote those things locally if they see fit. The thing that's interesting is we went from 3 years ago, just three or four people, I remember QA in 1.0, I called up our then chief architect, Glenn Bolton, and I said, do you think it's okay? And I said, I think it's okay. And he said, I think it's okay. Well, let's ship 1.0. And that was kind of the QA release process, was two people and a cell phone call. Our QA process now and our entire release process lasts a year. 10 months before release, we do a requirements prioritization, where we try to figure out what the community wants. 5 months before, we get all the people of the major projects together. We're going to have our next coordination meeting in Amsterdam on Saturday, June something or other, right before our conference in Amsterdam. And the last one, we had about 35 people. They were all the lead committers for all Sakai, and they kind of horse trade as to what has to be done across projects and agree the rough scope of a release. Then we work for 3 more months and then do 2 months of quality assurance, and we release a product that we commit to maintaining a branch of that product for at least 12 months after the release. And so you can see that we're slowly but surely going from a crazy Wild West, you know, one cell phone call and release, to looking an awful lot like a company. But all the people are still volunteers in this company. Mark Norton is a long-term member of the Sakai community, and he's our requirements coordinator. He does this part-time. We have a lot of employees that are part-time, and they have regular jobs, and we think this is a really healthy way to do things because, you know, they don't get so, they're not 100% Sakai, and so they have their regular job, and then they can kind of blend the two things together. So the the biggest thing about requirements is that we have literally millions of users and certainly thousands of local people at each school who care deeply about Sakai, and we have hundreds of developers, and we have to have a way to get those communities talking together. So our requirements process is what does this. We gather requirements continuously, but then twice a year for each release we do a prioritization process. And Mark runs a smaller group of people that try to read through the requirements, clump them, categorize them, and then we go through two voting phases where the whole community votes on things and then the people who pay money vote on things as well. Interesting, and then we produce this high-level summary document of all that activity. So here's an example of a set of requirements. We now have hundreds and hundreds of requirements. And basically, if you look at the requirements, the nice thing about this is coming from a community that's actually adopting and using Sakai, and they can very much cut to the heart of what needs to be changed in Sakai to improve it for their teaching and learning. The community requirement summary for Sakai 2.4 had the following assessment, had some performance issues in Sakai. That was seen as the top priority for the community, migration, portfolio. These are in top to bottom order. And the interesting thing is that even though we go through this process and produce this document, have all this voting, that doesn't mean anything, really, because these people are still volunteers. All the people doing the work don't work for me or don't work for the requirements people. And so there's no rule that says that you must work on X. The last thing we ever want to do is call some volunteer developer up and say, stop working on what you want to work on, and you got to work on this right now. They're like, hey, I'm a volunteer, right? I mean, I'm not going to do what you say. And then next thing you know, they just leave because we've ticked them off. And so you'd think that this would be ignored, but it turns out that developers, even though they're volunteers, actually want to satisfy what the users want. And if we can put in front of them an expression of what the users want in a very clear and concise manner, we did this for the first time for our 2.4 release, and sent them effectively a two-page document that summarized. Now, if you want to go to all the requirements, you can do it, but it gets in developers' minds 6 to 8 months before the release what it is the community has talked about their particular product. And so this turned out to be really good. And what happened was the amount of effort that we saw happen across the Sakai community for the 2.4 release was surprisingly related to the requirements process, even though there was not a strict connection between them. Do our requirements all in the open. There's a Confluence site, so there's web pages and various other things, and you can take a look at it. So the requirements is kind of the long-term view of Sakai in terms of planning and process. The short-term, the tactical, is a fellow named Peter Nuke. He's our project coordinator. And the problem is people are doing lots of stuff. This has not worked as well as we hoped. The idea of project coordination was, Apache has this thing they call the PMC. The idea was not to necessarily give people deadlines and track them on deadlines and yell at them if they miss the deadlines, but instead to communicate from group to group to group so that group A would know what group B is doing, group C, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with that, frankly, is that developers have been working with project managers for too long, and they are used to people yelling at them. So the project manager goes, just tell me roughly when that's going to be done. No, it's okay. I won't hurt you. Just tell me what it is. And then like 1 month later, they say, I think it'll take a month. The project manager calling, you're not done. And so what happens is, and this is bad, it's going to take a long time. Developers want to work in secret. They're happy to be informed by the requirements, and they surprisingly work on the requirements. And the stuff that comes out right before code freeze, it's like amazingly beautiful stuff that's amazingly, handles what we need. But they never told us what they were going to do because they didn't want to commit and get their head bashed in because we're so used to project managers who are obsessive and just are date-driven and just have unlimited cell phone minutes and just call people and yell at them. So that's something that we're working on. That's something I think that will take us some time. We have a project. All we want from them is once a month a one-sentence summary of what they're doing, and that is difficult to get because people are really, really gun-shy about reporting their plans to people who are going, they think is going to yell. I would have thought that project coordination would have worked. Now, the funny thing is, I'm part of that, and I get asked, and I don't give him the answer because I'm afraid that he'll yell at me if I don't get it done right. So I thought it was going to be a success, but we're still working on it. Something that I thought was going to be a complete and total failure that has turned out to be a glorious success is quality assurance. I tell a little story of our first QA directors. Her name was Carol Dippel. She worked for free for a year and a half. She's a professional out of the Bay Area that's worked with Gap and Levi's and whatever. So she just got a master's degree in something or other, and she said, I want to play with an open source project. And so Joseph Harden, my boss at the time, said, you should go talk to this lady, Carol, who wants to do QA for us. And I go, yeah, right, that'll work. He says, no, but you go talk to her. I will talk to her. So finally, I ended up in the Bay Area, and I said, oh, Carol, let's go have dinner. I'll buy you dinner. So I sat Carol down, and I told her, I said, so let me tell you about QA, Carol. I hate QA. QA people are mostly losers. They're people that can't get real jobs in this world. And mostly what they want to do is yell at people because they're not filling out enough paperwork. You know the theme of yelling at people, right? And they don't really actually do anything, right? And they're the weakest people in the organization, yada, yada, yada. And she said, Chuck, we're going to get along just fine. She said, I've met a zillion of you. And at the end of the process, every one of you liked me, believe me. And she was right. Because she took a very active approach to quality assurance, a very engaged approach to quality assurance, a very non-paperwork approach to quality assurance, a very, you know, not pitting people against one another, but instead very, you know, she has this thing called white box quality. So she did just a wonderful job. And then, you know, she couldn't keep doing it as a volunteer, and then we picked Megan up, and Megan followed on. So that's one thing. I certainly learned a lesson about quality assurance from both Carol and from Megan. But the other thing that's interesting is I've wondered where we were going to find volunteers to do QA. We're in the middle of QA process right now, and I was chatting with Megan just this morning, and she's saying, man, we're getting all kinds of bugs, and we're getting fixes, and everything's working really good. We might have to slip the release a bit because we're finding so many things so quickly and fixing them so quickly. And I said, if we're finding them like that, we should go ahead and, you know, fix them all. Let's not, like, stop fixing bugs. And so we have a wonderful QA operation. So what happened that made it really cool was it turned out that 2 years ago, the way QA worked in Sakai was most schools didn't want to participate in the foundation QA period. They said, ah, yeah, someone else will do that. Someone else will do the QA. And you guys finish up a release, and then we'll pull it in and download it and run it to our school, and then we'll have our QA people work on that QA it right before, like, you know, release it in June. Foundation QA is in May, release in June, then schools grab it in July or August, they put it up, and then they queue it in July and August, right? And then they want to put it in production in September. Well, people learned that was a mistake pretty quickly, because by July and August, the developers are actually working on the code that's going to be coming out in October. And they really did not want to hear from 50 different schools all over the planet for bugs in July and August. So what happened was, the people who were doing local tech support realized the one time that they could have the developers' undivided attention was April and May. And if they moved their QA up into April and May, then every bug that they asked would be on the list. We have QA director, we have meetings weekly, we check these things through. So all of a sudden, you got a lot of respect as a QA person if you did it in the right time frame. So within the next release, everybody switched to doing QA in the thing. So we have sometimes 40 to 60 people doing QA, not being paid a penny, totally coordinated. So it's a very, very exciting thing that I would have not expected to succeed. But everything in Sakai that ultimately succeeds because people are inherently selfish. So even this QA volunteerism is something that these people who are going to be running it in the fall selfishly help us QA in May because it makes their life better. It's not because they're trying to make the world a better place. It's because their life is better. We call it enlightened self-interest. Our job is to enlighten people to understand what their self-interest really is. And in any kind of an organization like Sakai, you got members and people need to be taken care of, and someone needs help on an RFQ, and then someone needs something put on the map. And Anthony White, who is here with me as well, does this, and he's also our security officer, and we have some people that do membership and communications. I'm pretty proud of our security procedures. We've had 4 sort of security emergency patches in 3 years. And all the code, if you did an SVN blame on all the code, my name is next to every line of code. I didn't write the lines of code. I took other people's patches sometimes without enough review. I am an agent of change in the organization, so I like to move forward, and sometimes I move forward a little too fast. But we evolved this in the last year and a half, and it's really a really important value is how you deal with security. We've got 200 sites and 1 million users, and it's very sensitive information. You've got to come up with a security scheme. So the first thing is it's absolutely not open. We try to do everything open that we possibly can, but we don't do security things open. We have back channels to the security officer, So that's, their security reports from any developer in the community or adopter go straight to the security officer. We do a non-public six-week process where we identify the threat rapidly. If it's bad enough, we drop everything, take every person we can, beg, borrow, and steal. You know, the last security fix that I was involved in, we got reported at 1 in the morning, Eastern time, and by 2 in the morning, I had people at various schools figuring out what versions were affected. We had the first patches out by 3 in the morning, and they were being tested in South Africa. It was daytime in South Africa, so we had a whole day of testing in South Africa. So within about 12 hours, we had the patch out and had been QA'd by using the entire globe of people to do it. And so the idea is once we have a patch, we distribute it to the known sites, which we maintain a list of, and then we go for about 2 weeks where we say, who's got it? And we keep telling the people who are on our list to get the patch. Then after we believe 90 to 95% of the production sites are already patched, we publicly announce that we have a security problem. And we tell people, if you don't have the patch, that must mean you better get a hold of us. And so that improves our list. And so we improve the list, and then we go another 2 weeks where we send the sites, the patches that we find that aren't on our list. And then at the point where we think that 90% of all sites have the patch, we actually check the patch into the source tree, and then a few weeks to 3 to 4 weeks, we have a dot release. So I'll close. Membership in the Sakai Foundation is $10,000. It is absolutely optional. It's like public radio. You can still listen to the radio. You can still use Sakai. You can be part of the community. You can be a committer. You can do anything you want. You can come to the... There's really very little things that are unique to members. But the only thing that members get that's different is sometimes we have secrets that we can't tell, and we can only tell the members. And so that's... So you get sometimes the secrets. So there's only like about 2 or 3 that are good, juicy secrets that we've shared with our members. So, but good, that's $3,000 a secret, so that's not good. We just really are passionate about the fact that this is, the people who are supporting Sakai need to support all of Sakai, not just themselves, right? When you're giving money to Sakai, you're giving money to Sakai for everybody. And so that's... We have a conference coming up in Amsterdam on June 12th through the 14th. June 10th will be our coordination meeting. I'll be at EDUCAUSE in a couple of weeks doing some workshops and giving a keynote. And then June the 24th to the 27th, we're going to have a JASIG meeting in the Sakai track. And www.sakaiproject.org is where all the rest of the information is. Any questions? How much time do we have?